David Brown, as I mentioned at the beginning in the introduction, your new book, Fire and Rain, it sort of tells the story of 1970 from four perspectives, and you weave it together like a novel. You tell it from the beginning of the year from four perspectives, then you take it on down through the year at different times, different seasons. Let's go back to the Beatles now. At the beginning of 1970, and I want to take it back even further, obviously there are signs that they're about to break up. But how big they were, how important they were as a musical act and as a social force?
It's almost hard to underestimate that, especially now when, you know, rock and roll seems like such a, an accepted mainstream form of entertainment in a way. To remember how large the Beatles loomed, you know, rock and roll was only about 15 years old at that point, too, which you also have to keep in mind. There weren't that many. There were a lot of bands and a lot of singers, but not quite the history of that we have now. And at that point, the Beatles had been around, you know, roughly a decade. They sold millions of records. People took their cues of how to make records, how to dress, and everything from them. There was financially what was really interesting. And one of the things I found in some court papers I found about their breakup was that that year in 1970, they received a royalty check for their record sales in America from the end of 69 through about the fall of 1970. And that check was for $10 million. That's in 1970, you know. It's a huge amount of money now. But it was a massive amount of money then, and it shows you no one came close to that at that point.
That's just U.S. sales, American sales. That's just U.S.
U.S. Yes, yeah, that was right. Just the U.S. money. Yes, they made a comparable amount in the rest of the world. So it's not to just peg them as a financial force. They were financial and a cultural. They were these sort of icons, and the fact that they hadn't done any concerts in several years at that point also added to their mystique. Again, we're at a point in the culture now where you can turn on the TV and see pop stars, you know, on reality shows and hosting American Idol and everything else. But, you know, the Beatles, they weren't in our faces like that in that way. And rock and roll wasn't. And that really also added to their power. So when one of them would suddenly appear, like when John Lennon appeared for that concert in Toronto in the fall of 69, that was a huge deal. It's like, oh my God, we're seeing a Beatle in person. You know, people went crazy about that.
I think people forget about how prolific they were. They, you know, you look back now on the body of work, it's a tremendous body of work, but it was a fairly compressed time period there. They would put out an album. They're back in the studio within a matter of weeks working on the next one. Not like now, you got an artist puts out an album and it's 2 years before he can crank out enough material for another one.
It's true. I mean, isn't it mind-boggling that they would put out two or three albums a year, and, you know, that, again, yeah, it's completely different than now. I mean, now, you know, maybe a new musician might put out a new song, you know, two or three new songs a year on the internet, and then, you know, there'll be an eventual album or something. But just the idea that within the course of a year and a half, you had White Album, Abbey Road, Let It Be, just in the course of a year and a half. It's kind of a staggering thing to think about. The number of songs there were, how many of them were great, you know. Beatle albums were not known for their filler. I think we all know, like, every single song, every one of their records, you know, there's an occasional, you know, dud. But the ratio, the quality is extraordinary.
And it seemed like every album got better. I'm not sure that Let It Be is better than Abbey Road, which I, you know, personally, I think it's about their best, but it certainly is. And Let It Be is no slacker.
Right. Yeah, Let It Be, I think, has suffered by comparison to that. It was recorded before Abbey Road. It's a little sloppier and sort of intentionally so. And Abbey Road was really a more, you know, full-on produced studio production. It really was their kind of last hurrah. But, you know, Let It Be has actually aged a lot better, I think, than anyone might have thought at the time. Because at the time when it was released, it really was considered a letdown after Abbey Road. But, you know, it's a record that has Let It Be and The Long and Winding Road and Across the Universe and, Even sort of minor songs like "Dig a Pony" from John, that rocker. You know, that record really captures something that I think some of the other records, like "Let It Be," like Abbey Road and the White Albums, and even Sgt. Pepper, didn't capture quite as well, which is the sound of them performing together as a band. Because that was the whole point of "Let It Be." We're gonna get together, the four of us, in the studio. We're not gonna have do orchestral overdubs. We're not gonna have layers of production. This is just gonna be us, almost like unplugged, you know, performing with each other as a quartet, with occasional Billy Preston on a keyboard. But for the most part, us live in the studio, in your face, and there's a real energy to that. Throughout that album, it really does capture that, and I think it's really valuable for that reason.
And it was sort of like, let's get back to what was fun about this in the first place.
Exactly, and that was the original title of the record too, and the movie "Get Back," because they did want to get back, you know, to what fun they had just performing live as a group, you know, and sort of rocking out in that way that they did way back, you know, in the Cavern Club in all those early days. It's ironic that idea would sort of collapse, you know, around them instead of bringing them together. It ultimately drove them apart.
So as 70 is beginning, what are the sources of the dissolution of the group? What are the sources of conflict between McCartney and Lennon and to a lesser extent, Ringo and George Harrison?
You know, there were many. I mean, certainly, Yoko Ono is always brought up as one, but that was actually just one of many things that were kind of driving them apart. I think at that point they were all either 29 or 30 years old. They were all in that age range. They were all married. They all had these like separate sort of mansions. You know, they were no longer kind of living even remotely close to each other. So there was a kind of physical distance that was coming between them. There was a creative kind of distance. I think John in particular, you know, hated certain things on Abbey Road, like Maxwell's Silver Hammer. You know, just drove him crazy, and he was just getting kind of tired of what he saw as Paul's sort of dominance of the group. You also had other things tearing them apart on the business end. Their manager Brian Epstein had died in 1967, and ever since then they tried to take matters into their own hands. Always a tricky proposition when it comes to entertainers and business. And they had started Apple Records, which was also a clothing store and a record company, and it, well, all these things, a film studio all in one. So it was kind of a lovely idea, but sort of a hard thing to really get working on so many levels. And they needed someone to basically take care of their business. John and George and Ringo wanted a man named Alan Klein, kind of famously, you know, pugnacious and a combative former accountant from New Jersey who had helped guide the financial careers of a number of people throughout the 60s. Paul, on the other hand, wanted his new wife Linda's father, Lee Eastman, and his son John to take over and run the things. And they were basically both those two camps were unwielding to the other.